Money FM 89.3, the best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Value versus growth. The debate has been given fresh impetus by the performance of the Magnificent Seven and other growth stocks that we've seen in the US, also Europe. Since the start of 2023, we've seen the growth segment move, you know, and decouple from value stocks. For the time being, the dominance of growth stocks has continued. Some say the argument for looking into growth stocks for your portfolio has even increased. But what about value stocks? How have they performed this year? Could this be their time to shine? And then we head over. We've been talking about the price of cocoa and how that's been spiking. We look at food inflation and the price of crops ticking up. What are some key drivers? And how could this affect us as consumers and investors? Time to check in with Cheng Chai Sun, who's head of investment at Provident. Good morning, Chai Sun. How are you?
Morning, Michelle. Doing good.
Good to hear. Let's start off. How do you think value stocks have performed so far this year? What do you think are some likely catalysts for the price movements we've seen in the sector?
I think it's great that we are getting the chance to talk about value stocks. So thanks for the question. Value stocks are, you know, essentially stocks that are priced lower by investors for various reasons, and contrast with growth stocks that trade typically at more lofty valuations. And I think for most of the past decade, as you mentioned earlier, growth stocks have been in the limelight as PE multiples have expanded. And it's largely been driven by a lot of the tech stocks. So the FANGs and then the Magnificent Seven, and now it's NVIDIA that's driving this AI boom. But, you know, there are many different stocks out there outside of these tech stocks. And in March, really, it seems like investors started to take notice of them. So if we look at the S&P 500 performance in March, it was up 3.1%. But if we look at sector performance, it wasn't IT or communication that really delivered this performance. It was actually financials, which was up 4.4%, industrials up 4.1%, energy up 9.6%, and materials up about 6%. So if you look at all these different sectors, it wasn't really the typical growth stock sectors that was delivering the performance. These were definitely the stocks have been less loved, a bit more value stocks that were delivering this performance. And if you want to say, oh, the S&P 500 is, you know, too small a sample, we looked at the Russell indexes and we see that, you know, for both large and small cap US stocks, value did better than growth in March. So we can see that value has sort of had a bit of a comeback in March. And I guess the big question really is, why is this the case and is it going to carry on? And I think a large part of this catalyst is coming from higher commodity prices due to stronger demand, because economic growth both in the US and in China has been either holding up well or it's been coming back stronger. And that bodes well for these sectors like financials, industrials, materials, energy, that are all a bit more cyclical. They're all dependent on the economic cycle. And if the economic cycle is strong and, you know, the sort of fears about recession because of high interest rates have receded, that means that these value stocks are likely to do a bit better going forward. And I think also an interest rate environment that remains stable, that doesn't like move up or down who suddenly will also benefit value stocks, as that allows investors, you know, to properly price in how much future cash flows are worth, especially for growth stocks, which typically have much higher multiples. So a lot of their cash flow is projected in the far future. And so if there's a more stable discount rate, investors can anticipate and value those companies a bit more accurately.
Let me ask you, okay, mm-hmm. Please continue. And
oh, just going to say, if these factors thought. All sort of stay the same, mm-hmm. then we could see a broadening of the market rally, which will continue to benefit some of these less loved value stocks.
Okay, I'm going to press you on that one. Do you think falling interest rates and moderate inflation and growth could continue to support growth stocks? I mean, even though we have expectations of interest rate cuts in the US and the Eurozone retreating significantly since the start of the year. So basically, if the rate cuts are smaller and perhaps less frequent than the broad market expects, would this create a supportive environment for value stocks?
I think so. I think if the rate cuts don't come in so fast, I mean, it means a couple of things. Rate cuts are usually in response to sort of slowing growth. I mean, one of the main concerns that that the Fed is bringing up to some rate cuts at all is because they are afraid that conditions are too tight and it will slow down economic growth. So if rate cuts don't happen so quickly or they don't happen in as large a magnitude, then what that likely means is that the economy is doing fine. And if the economy is doing fine, that will sort of support these value stocks a bit more.
All right, Chaisen, let's segue and get your thoughts on key takeaways of the recent Fed movements, the FOMC meeting minutes. First up, talk to us a little bit about this change of expectations in the market around interest rates by the Fed. What do you make of the reasons supporting this argument?
Oh, yeah. I think that's a very apt question because of what happened last night. I mean, definitely the market has adjusted its expectations around a Fed rate cut in July. I think just last week it was, markets were pricing in through the Fed funds futures rate almost 100% probability of a rate cut. But now after last night, it's fallen to around 50% because of that very hot CPI reading. And like I mentioned earlier, I think the Fed has, a dual mandate. They need to try and, control inflation, but they also want to ensure that there's a good, strong, healthy labor market. And, that sort of means good economic growth. And so if, the reasons for the Fed to want to cut rates are because credit conditions are too tight and restricting economic growth. And the thing really is that the data isn't showing that economic growth is slowing or that credit conditions are, too tight. We just had a really strong jobs report that came out on Friday that already had people start to question if there is going to be sort of a lot of rate cuts coming later in the year because over 300,000 jobs were created. And then unemployment was still below 4% at 3.8%. So that shows that economic conditions are pretty good. And then, well, we still have stocks at very close to all-time highs, which isn't really a symptom of credit and money being very constrained. And I think the last part of it is the Fed has to control inflation. And then we also see that inflation, trying to bring inflation in the last mile down to 2%, it's quite tricky. So we've been hovering around this 3%-ish kind of level, and it's been actually going up. So last month's reading was 3.2%, and then last night they had a reading of 3.5%, which was above expectations. So it's sort of bucking that falling inflation trend. So, the initial euphoria over rate cuts has definitely become a lot more realistic now, and it seems like the market are expecting maybe rate cuts won't even happen until November.
Okay, that's a key point there. Interesting. Let's turn to food inflation. We've been talking so much about cocoa prices really stealing the limelight with its red-hot rally. Prices of other major crops also ticking up, and that is reviving the idea that food inflation has remained high in parts of the world, although we saw some moderation, I think, in the OECD. Food inflation in the world's richest nations falling to pre-Ukraine war levels. But overall, what do you think are some factors influencing food inflation? And do you expect it will trend lower?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. Food inflation has definitely been challenging for many countries in the world. Like you mentioned, across the OECD countries, food inflation actually peaked at 16.2% in November 2022. So that was some really high levels of food inflation, even across the developed world. Mm-hmm. And that has fallen to levels that are now sort of pre-Ukraine war, as you mentioned, 5.3%. Even in Singapore, Our food inflation, it's not 5%, thankfully, but it's been a slight uptrend due to Chinese New Year. In February, it was 3.8% after a 3.3% read in January. And a lot of this can be traced back to a few key issues. So we had a big disruption of supply chains due to COVID. It took a while for supply chains to realign. And then after that, economies, due to lockdowns and COVID, they sort of opened up after a high stimulus. There was a lot of cash given to people and they had no chance to spend it. So when there was reopening, there's a lot of demand for services, which also pushed up some food demand. But I think the big one is that the Ukraine war disrupted both food and energy supplies. So like things like Russian oil, Ukraine wheat and fertilizer all suddenly had to be replaced with more expensive sources from elsewhere. And that really contributed to rising prices. I think the good news is that in general, as we can see from the data, the food inflation has been trending down as markets have adjusted to changing supply chains. But I think the thing about food and the thing about agriculture is that we are subject to shocks always because of nature. And with changing climate patterns, it also has the potential to affect harvest. And then there are various supply chain disruptions because some countries might look to secure their food supplies. And for example, India's rice export ban has been pushing up the price of rice, while the price of other cereals have sort of been moderating more recently. And I think lastly, we see rising energy prices. I think oil prices have shot up quite a bit. And that can also limit the fall in food inflation because energy factors a lot into processing and transport costs. So as we can see, it's a very complex situation, depends on a lot of interconnected supply chains, depends on things out of our control, like the weather. So I think, you know, it's good that it's been moderating, but as you can see, the price of cocoa, price of energy, likely will still be having various bouts of food inflation into 2024 as the world adjusts to new uncertainties.
Speaking of new uncertainties, we were just talking about the energy gap this morning, discussing how the International Energy Agency says data centers are set to more than double their energy consumption by 2026, largely because of all the power needed to run generative AI. And, you know, we were discussing whether it's reason to go out and buy energy stocks. But let's take a step back. In the U.S. market, we've seen some lag in tech, while oil and gas stocks have emerged as some of the year's best performers, the energy sector posting a 17.1% return in the year-to-date period. That's the second highest sector return, nearly double that 9.1% return from the S&P 500 and 7.1% gain from the tech sector. What do you think are some catalysts for the strong performance in energy stocks?
Well, I think that's quite simple in the sense that it's just higher oil prices. Higher oil prices have been the tailwind really for energy stocks. And I mean, the reason really for the spike, especially recently, is that markets are very concerned that there will be further escalation of the conflict in the Middle East and that will have the potential to further disrupt oil supply. I think the other challenge is that most of the world has already been cutting back on investing in future oil supply. A lot of the oil majors have been cutting back on that investment as they look to move and transition towards more sustainable sources. So we're still sort of currently dependent on the current sources of supply for oil. And a large source of that is really from the Middle East. So any escalation of the conflict there might affect shipping routes. And as you can see, there's already some impact on shipping routes due to the attacks on the ships in the Red Sea. And that's likely to be a catalyst for, you know, higher oil prices than what we see now. And that's sort of one side, the supply side. I guess another part that affects the supply is that OPEC is sort of pushing still to cut around 5% of production. What that means is that we have a situation where the producers are trying to reduce supply a bit, and then there's a lot of fear that, you know, supply will be disrupted due to unforeseen events. But on the demand side, actually what we are also seeing is that the stronger U.S. economic recovery, or rather the just the stronger economy in general, as you can see from the jobs report, from the economic growth, from the production numbers, that sort of expected to drive demand, as is, of course, powering a lot of data centers, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
And also, China is also, their economy is also starting to recover. Of course, it's going to take a while to get back to the levels that they were at before, but still, you know, their economy is recovering. They're producing, continuing to manufacture and produce many goods that the rest of the world needs. And so all this, especially these two largest economies in the world, if their economies are humming along, it's going to drive oil demand as they use a lot of energy to power their economic engine. So, yeah, for these reasons, can expect that, you know, oil prices, especially if there's a sudden shock to supply, will continue to stay high. And that does bode well for the energy sector, as you mentioned. They have outperformed all the index, and they've also outperformed the tech stocks. So
yeah,
we can see how sensitive all these energy stocks are to the hike in the price of oil. And that does mean that, energy could be a dark horse of 2024. But I think the one challenge with investing in energy is that a lot of these factors are dependent on things far out of any investor's control.
Yeah.
So, you know, while it's great to have some energy in your portfolio, I think, you know, investors should keep their portfolios diversified and, you know, think carefully about their risk tolerance when they allocate.
I mean, just a couple of months ago, not so many investors were bullish on oil and gas and, you know, and now it's hand over fist, energy stocks. But I guess, as you say, so much will depend on the oil price trajectory. This question of how long and how high this so far quiet rally could reach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Chison's big oiled out. All right. Well, thank you so much. And diversification, of course, being the key to anything else you wanted to add on energy as the dark horse of 2024?
Well, I think, I mean, investors should just do their own due diligence, of course. And if they do need advice, should speak to a qualified and licensed advisor if they want to change their portfolio.
All right. Always fantastic to speak with you, Chison. Thank you for sharing your insights with me today.
Thanks, Michelle.
He's Cheng Chison, Head of Investment at Provident. Today, we talked about a lot, didn't we? Yes, we did. And you can hear it all over again if you want to hear that debate between value and growth stocks, food inflation, why so high in some parts of the world, how's it doing here in Singapore, what are some key drivers, and what does this all mean for you?
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO, audio at the App Store and Google Play.